there's an obvious temptation for me as a preacher and pastor as I come to speak on tonight's gospel reading. I understand that our financial offerings are running a little below budget, possibly below the last few years' levels as well, and even though our average attendance has been rising. And here we have the story usually titled The Widow's Mite, in which Jesus points to a poor widow who puts everything that she's got into the temple offering box and then contrasts her with much wealthier people who have only given a little of their surplus. How easy it would be to grab the opportunity for a stewardship sermon and exhort everyone to give sacrificially and boost our offerings to get our finances back in robust health. And no doubt in many churches around the world today, that is pretty much exactly what will be preached. Some will probably designate this as Stewardship Sunday and kick off a big push to boost offerings or clear some debts or start new building funds. Most of those tele-evangelist types who are always asking people to send in those their donations don't actually follow the same cycle of Bible readings as us, but you can be sure that this story comes up quite often in their impassioned appeals for more money. But there's a nasty trap here for us preachers who might fall for this obvious temptation. We may be missing the point of the story and veering dangerously towards exactly the sort of behaviour that Jesus was condemning when he told this story. A few of you have told me that you have been appreciating some of the insights I've been giving you in recent sermons into the ways that different stories in Mark's Gospel make reference to each other and so are better understood in relation to one another instead of in isolation. And indeed, this is another one of those stories of which it is very easy to miss the point if you look at it on its own. But with this one, you don't even have to turn the pages back and you don't even have to go beyond the extract that we heard tonight. But it's amazing how easily we can hear an extract and hear actually only part of it, not notice the context it has. When we see it, suddenly it appears that maybe Jesus wasn't celebrating the widow's generosity at all. He's not criticising her either, but maybe he was lamenting an awful injustice that she has fallen victim to and exposing the perpetrators. What was Jesus talking about in the lines immediately before the description of the widow and her offering? Here's what it says. As he taught, Jesus said, "Beware of the religious experts who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honour at banquets. They devour widows' houses, and for the sake of appearances say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." And then he sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury and said, "This poor widow, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." So there we have these religious hotshots devour widows' houses. See, this impoverished widow has just given them everything she's got, everything she had to live on. And suddenly I'm losing my taste for a stewardship sermon because suddenly it seems that what Jesus is doing is lamenting the plight of the impoverished victim of one too many stewardship sermons that manipulate vulnerable people into giving above and beyond what they can actually afford to give, usually with the promise that by so doing they will not only please God, but it will result in God pouring out rich blessings and rewarding them tenfold or a hundredfold. I've heard a fair few of those stewardship sermons and tithing appeals, and some of them begin to sound suspiciously like the advertising pitches of the gambling industry. You've got to be in it to win it. The more you put in, the greater your odds of reaping rich benefits. If you just add a few God words, you end up with the more money you put in here, the more richly God will prosper you and reward you and bless you. Double your pledge and God will quadruple your blessing. That kind of thing. And if we go back a little bit in church history, it sounds suspiciously like some other sins that we have had to repent of. We built St. Peter's Basilica in Rome with the proceeds of the sale of indulgences, which callously exploited people's concern for the fate of their loved ones, by promising that their donations to the building fund could secure the release of their loved ones' souls from purgatory. It may not have been the worst sin ever committed by the church and its clergy, but it was one that led directly to the fracturing of the unity of the Western Church, a fractured unity from which we have never recovered. And maybe it's not too far-fetched to imagine a slippery slope that runs from the financial exploitation of vulnerable people under our pastoral care all the way to the sexual exploitation for which so many of my fellow pastors and priests are now being exposed and justly condemned. You see, that's actually where the thrust of this passage goes. It is about the exposure of abusive and exploitative behaviours by religious people and especially by religious leaders. It's not necessarily illegitimate to suggest that Jesus is commending the faith shown by the impoverished widow. He does imply that her faith and her open-handedness are worth more than the lucrative sponsorship deals and the well-publicised philanthropic donations of those who have more than enough left to live on comfortably, thank you very much. But that doesn't actually seem to be the real focus. Even when Jesus speaks of her faith and generosity, he seems to be pointing her out as evidence of his charges against the religious leaders. Beware of religious leaders who like to display their religiosity, to stand out from the crowd, to be treated with great reverence and deference in public, to have the seats of honour at public occasions. They love to be invited to give impressive prayers at important events and to get their own slots on television so they can build their profile and appeal for funds to a wider pool of donors. But behind this facade, they are feathering their nests by exploiting the gullibility of people who have been sold an image of God that looks a lot like a celestial slot machine. And they're sexually exploiting children and vulnerable adults who have trustingly looked to them for pastoral care and leadership. And then Jesus says a very interesting and rather confronting thing. He says, they will receive the greater condemnation. They will receive the greater condemnation. What is really interesting about this is that if you sit down sometime with the Gospels and try and find all the places where Jesus directs words or threats of condemnation against the conventional catalogue of sinners outside the community of the religious, you will come up almost entirely empty-handed. You can search in vain for examples of Jesus waving a Bible and screaming condemnations at gay people or remarried divorcees or abortionists or drug abusers or any of the other targets on the hit list of contemporary Christian hatred and fury. And here we have some evidence that this is not just an accidental omission on the part of his gospel writers. Jesus is quite clear. It is the religious people who trumpet their religiousness but cynically distort it into a means of furthering their own selfish and even corrupt interests who will receive the greater condemnation. Jesus shows very, very little interest in condemning the conventional garden variety sinners. The morality zealots are always very fond of the verse where Jesus tells the adulterous woman to go and sin no more. But the reason they're so fond of it is that that's about as close as you can get to finding Jesus speaking against somebody for their catalogue of pet sins. And it hardly sounds like condemnation, but it's about as close as you can find. Mostly, Jesus seems to only have words of welcome and acceptance and forgiveness and reconciliation for such people. It is for us religious people when we fail to follow his lead in such things, that he says they will receive the greater condemnation. So what are we to say about the widow herself and her contribution to the offering box? While there is no doubt that Jesus is lamenting the abusive system that left her feeling that she should put her essential housekeeping money into the temple treasury, he does seem to be quite impressed with her faith and commitment, and he does contrast her favourably with those who contributed more in dollar terms but far less as a percentage of their income. And I think this suggests that when we do start thinking about stewardship and tithing and church finances, we need to make sure that we think communally and not just individually. We need to be aware that the financial decisions we make as a church community impact on one another. And we need to watch that we are not putting undue pressure on those who are least resourced to deal with it. As a Baptist congregation, we are financially autonomous. Our bills are not covered by some head office somewhere. When we decide to employ a pastor or renovate the toilets or even just turn the lights on, it's up to us to cover the cost of those things out of our own pockets. But our pockets are not all equally deep, as Jesus' observation at the treasury box makes clear. And so when we're planning what we will spend, we need to ensure that we're not increasing the costs and then putting pressure on members who have very little to spare to increase their offerings. And on the other side, those of us who are more financially comfortable need to be aware that if we don't pull our weight, then and our weight may be greater than others, then we are thereby increasing the pressure on others because we share the responsibility. And since I'm starting to veer towards a stewardship sermon after all, let me assure you that I don't stand to gain personally from any increase in the offerings. I am paid at a set rate that is proposed by the Baptist Union and ratified by you, and while your offerings contribute to that, my pay does not rise or fall with them. So your offerings are not about supporting my ministry in the way that is the case with many of the kind of tele-evangelism ministries. What they are about is all of us together taking responsibility for the financial obligations that we've taken on together. And though we don't usually make a big deal about it, we've got a formula here that we recommend for people when considering calculating their minimum offering, because that formula is designed to first ensure that people who have very little are not expected to pull above their weight in the church finances. The widow with her mite was pulling well above her weight in the temple finances. And Jesus is scathing in his condemnation of the system and its organisers that would make her feel that sacrificing her needs, not her wants, but her basic needs, is what God required of her. Well, if this was an opportunity for a stewardship sermon, I'm sure it's been a squandered opportunity, because I suspect that my observations are probably made more likely to make some people feel less burdened to give than others more burdened, even though quite possibly some should be feeling more burdened. I wouldn't know. I've got no idea what most of you give, and I don't want to. But what I do hope that you've taken from this gospel story is this call to integrity, this sense that integrity really matters, and especially so among church leaders. At times, at a time when scandalous abuse by pastors and priests is all over the newspapers, we need to be vigilant in ensuring that we do not create and perpetuate cultures that put some people above question or above the law, and thereby foster a climate that is conducive to abuse. We've had scandals before here in this congregation, and we need to take it seriously even at our little local level. So if you have concerns about me or about others in leadership here, don't be afraid to raise them. Sometime in the next few weeks, there will be another pastoral review. It'll be smaller in scale than last year's, but it will still provide an additional opportunity for you to provide feedback or raise concerns if they exist. Pastoral ministry is something that comes with a unique set of temptations and vulnerabilities. And as committed to transparency as I am, I'm not without my blind spots. Your feedback may help to identify a worrying emerging pattern in the way I operate that I haven't even become aware of myself yet. It's part of my job to ask such questions of you, but ideally it is part of your job to ask them of me also when I need them. As followers of Jesus, we can be calling each other to more fully live out our calling. You might not have more than a mite to put in the offering plate, but we can all play our part in urging one another to be the kind of community that will not be the ones that receive Jesus' greater condemnation.